We have for you a discovery more than 2,000 years in the making. An Israeli archaeologist says he has found the lost tomb of King Herod, ruler of Jerusalem when Jesus was born. He unearthed pieces of an ornate limestone coffin after more than 30 years of digging in the desert.
Well, there's the story. Herod's tomb allegedly found. We're going to find out how much substance there is to this story. It seems like just about every month there's a new breakthrough archaeological discovery. A lot of these stories have lag time with the general public because the discoveries might have been made several years or maybe even several decades ago. Some of them are a little more recent. We're going to be talking about Herod's tomb, King Herod, the famous Herod. Of course, when you talk Herod, you got to sort one Herod from another because it's more a dynasty than it is an individual person. Dr. Paul Meyer will join us here in the very first half hour of Issues Etc. as we come to you live this Tuesday, the 8th of May, talking about Herod's tomb. How significant a discovery is this? And then Pastor John Loom will join us. We're going to talk about Western women and Islam. Why is it that Western women seem to be more prone, especially after 9/11, to convert to Islam here in the West? After that conversation in the second hour of the program, Dr. David Anderson will be our guest. We're going to talk about a formation of a U.S. branch of the Anglican Church of Nigeria. We all know the context of this. The Episcopal Church is cracking up. And in the course of that breakup, the congregations that are see fit to find a different way of being Anglican in America than the Episcopal Church USA are appealing for help from outside the U.S. So we'll get the story from Reverend David Anderson of the American Anglican Council based in Atlanta. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will be our guest at 4:30. Two subjects for him, one so dear to his heart, that is the French presidential elections. I imagine he might be singing the French national anthem. If we can prevail upon him during that short conversation, we might get him to sing the French national anthem for us. And then also presidential elections in Turkey are slower in coming, but they're as significant in world politics. We'll find out what this international human rights attorney, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thinks about those elections coming up at 4:30. Then in the 5 o'clock hour, some audio open lines. A regular guest here on the program and one of the leading lights in evangelicalism, at least he was considered such, Dr. Frank Beckwith, has converted to the Roman Church. We'll hear some sound bites from AP Radio, what he has to say about his conversion. There's a CNN story on churches that are harboring illegal immigrants and an ABC News report about a sex offender who is being, well, the congregation is still trying to decide whether they want this registered sex offender to be an official member of their congregation. There's also an NBC News story titled, Will Fred Thompson Run? It's a big question. We'll talk about it during audio open lines, the third hour of the program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address this Tuesday, the 8th of May, issues etc@kfuo.org. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
Well, this sounds like a big story. How significant of a find is it if they've actually discovered a tomb of King Herod?
Well, if it's authentic, of course, it's of major, major importance. Here's a tremendously important figure in the New Testament. He's the founder of the Herodian dynasty. You know, there are four different Herods in the New Testament. One's a son, another's a nephew, another's a grandson, and the great-grandson, Herod Agrippa II, is the one before whom St. Paul stood at Caesarea, you recall. So, indeed, if the find is authentic, then it's a fabulous discovery. There's no question about it.
Why did it take so long? I mean, the locations of his palaces and his various locales of his residences and the various Herod's residences have been no real mystery, have they?
Well, first of all, there was never any mystery about where Herod was buried. The general area was known to Josephus. Of course, he's my favorite source, as you well know. First-century Jewish historian who gives us such terrific detail, you know, in regard to biblical events. He devotes two whole books to Herod the Great, and so he gives us some detail on where he was buried. We know it's the Herodium, a great mound that he erected southeast of Bethlehem. He actually took off the top of a neighboring mountain to add more to it, so it's a beautiful pyramidal shape, and there have been excavations near the top of that mound, and a vast palace has been uncovered, faithfully reported by Josephus. He says there were watchtowers and everything else, and there was a long a 200-step marble stairway getting up to the site. And it's he had opulent palaces built there as kind of a necropolis, a city of the dead almost. And so we know it was somewhere in that particular mound, and there have been attempts, I guess, for the last 30 years or so of trying to find where was his sarcophagus. The one thing that disappointed me when the news was announced just yesterday is that they did not find any bones, and they didn't find the sarcophagus intact at all, nor was there any inscription. Now, if someday they find one of these red limestone slabs that were broken up from the original sarcophagus, and if his name is on it, well, then it is major. And it may be major anyway. The reason, by the way, Todd, that it was broken up was because Jewish rebels took over the Herodium Fortress because of its military significance as a high point from which they could control the whole area. And they did this in 66 A.D. at the beginning of the Great War with Rome.
And they had no great love of Herod, did they?
No, Herod was never popular with his Jewish subjects, no. He was a great builder and taxed the people pretty strongly because of that.
So what exactly have they found? Pieces of a sarcophagus?
We don't have all the details yet. I respect enormously the archaeologist who's making the announcement. Ehud Netzer is very, very well known in biblical archaeological circles, and so I don't think he'd be any kind of a sensationalist who would come out with something like this if there weren't pretty strong evidence behind it. I think probably what he has are red limestone pieces with beautiful ornate carvings thereon, something you would just not find in a regular sarcophagus. And against that background, it could well be part of Herod's sarcophagus that was found at the northeastern corner of the Herodium, where the dig has been going on for quite a while. But there have been others who have tried to find it, and they simply have not found it.
So is this akin, I mean, the archaeological enterprise of looking for a tomb, a particular tomb, on one of these giant mounds, even though the location is well-known and well-excavated, is it akin to looking for a needle in a haystack?
Well, pretty close. It's very, very difficult. If you don't have the exact longitude and latitude, you don't quite know where to dig. And I'm sure that Herod anticipated that people might try to rob his tomb, and that's why he didn't put it in any center marketplace. A center pivotal spot surrounded by the towers in the Herodium. He, interestingly enough, evidently chose a northeastern corner for it, and maybe a little way down the hillside. That's where they found these red limestone pieces.
Tell us about Herod the Great. Give us his story.
Interestingly enough, we have more original source detail on Herod the Great than any other figure from the ancient world. I include Augustus, I include Julius Caesar, I include Jesus of Nazareth, I include St. Paul. We have more original source material on Herod, of all people, than anybody else, probably up to the year 1000 A.D. Why? Because Josephus, again, gives us so much intricate detail about his life story, his administration. He gives us a whole court history of Herod the Great in books 16 and 17 of his Antiquities of the Jews. And so we have this as firsthand evidence by this Jewish historian who lived in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, born in the city of Jerusalem just 4 years after Jesus' crucifixion. So he has kind of a box seat evidence on what he reports. In other words, his parents were directly contemporaries of Herod the Great.
And is Herod the Great at all, beyond Josephus' extensive history of him, does he figure in any way into New Testament history, or is he already gone and now we're dealing with his dynasty?
No, he figures very prominently in New Testament history, of course, because he's part of the Christmas story. When the Magi come to Jerusalem inquiring about the newborn king of the Jews, they're talking to Herod the Great.
Wow.
And it's in his last months, by the way. By now he's very sick. He's kind of a walking medical encyclopedia of diseases. And evidently he had everything from cancer to gonorrhea. And so when the Magi come along with their question, where is the newborn king of the Jews, you lame duck? It was kind of insulting to Herod, and that gets all his craftiness on edge. and that's the reason he wants the Magi to come back and tell him where the newborn king is, so he can come and worship him also. It's just like Herod that we find in Josephus, the same fingerprint as we see in Matthew's gospel.
What kind of a guy is Herod the Great?
Well, you know, the younger Herod, I'll really cut him some slack. He has every right to be called Herod the Great because nobody was able to keep the peace between Rome and Judea better than Herod. He was an enormous builder. My goodness, the great temple in Jerusalem in Jesus' day was Herod's construction. And so, you know, he should be given credit for some of this. He single-handedly built the port of Caesarea, where the Roman governors would hang their hat most of the year. Pontius Pilate was most of the time at Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea on the sea. And seven or eight other fortresses were very, very important, and he's given credit for those. He established diplomatic relations all over the Mediterranean. What soured Herod was the fact that he married 10 wives concurrently, and each of the wives produced princes who were scheming to succeed. And therefore, it turned the palace into a can of worms. You know, if there weren't two or three collateral plots before they had cornflakes in the morning, you know, something was wrong. And so this bred all kinds of suspicion in Herod's own mind. He executed three of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He put his favorite wife to death, the Maccabean princess Mariamne. He killed his mother-in-law. He killed an uncle, several cousins. He invited the high priest down for a swimming party at his Jerusalem palace in Jericho, I should say, at Jericho Palace, and he played a very rough game of water polo. They drowned him. So he's a pretty murderous character by now. He's kind of unhinged by the plotting going on behind his back in the palace, and the idea that he could have killed those babies in Bethlehem is very much agreement with what we know from the non-biblical sources.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the reported discovery of King Herod's tomb or another issue of biblical archaeology, give us a call now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can also send us your email right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. As I said, coming to you live this Tuesday, the 8th of May, in about 15 minutes, we're going to discuss Western women and Islam with Pastor John Loom. Now, Pastor Loom is going to join us here in the studio. He's director of the Ethnic Immigration Institute of Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Kind of sends chills down your spine to think that as the events of the early years of Christ's life are unfolding, somewhere in that time frame, Herod suffers death, and then is laid into this tomb that perhaps has been discovered so recently. It's really kind of chilling.
Well, it really is. You know, these archaeological discoveries are coming at us thick and fast, Todd. Great discoveries being made. You know, the bones of the first biblical character ever discovered came to light in November 1990. And again, there was some lead time there. They didn't announce it until 1992. I refer to the ossuary of Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest who indicted Jesus before Pontius Pilate in the morning of Good Friday. A sensational discovery that very few people seem to know about. I can't understand why the word isn't out. And this is not, you know, a hunch. This is very definitely authenticatable. And indeed, they've done carbon-14 tests on it and epigraphical tests and everything else. And we're talking about slam dunk on this one.
Why so, or at least why does it seem so many archaeological discoveries now? Why are they coming apparently so fast and furious?
Well, for one thing, because archaeology, scientific archaeology, has only been around for the last 100, 125 years. See, it's not a case of discoveries made every century going back 20 centuries to the New Testament horizon. It's a very young science, scientific archaeology. And now more and more digs are taking place. And so in the last part of that half century or more, you're going to have more discoveries just just on the math involved alone. And this also means, excuse me, that for the future there'll be even more to look forward to.
Let's talk with Andy, who's on the line in Kirkwood. Andy, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Hi, Dr. Meyer. It seemed to me that it might be useful, because of the what's been in the news lately, to have Dr. Meyer compare and contrast the bona fides of this discovery and that of the ossuary of Caiaphas to the so-called Jesus tomb that they'd found recently.
That's a great question, Andy. Make that comparison. I know you're anxious to do it, Dr. Meyer.
Well, there's everything pointing to the authenticity of the Caiaphas ossuary and this one, Andy. It's very important that you bring that out. The so-called Jesus family tomb is just hung by gossamer threads on a house of cards. I mean, there's just no convincing demonstration whatever that the Jesus family tomb is what it claims to be, simply because there were some names that occur both in that Talpiot discovery in South Jerusalem and in the New Testament. Means not a darn thing, because one out of four women in New Testament times were called Mary, and that's a name on one of those ossuaries. Not a big deal. And Yeshua, the true name for Jesus, you know, spelled in his own language, Josephus tells us there were 21 well-known Jesuses in his own day. And when he gives us two famous references to Ark Jesus, he calls him Jesus who's called the Christ. And then there were other Jesuses as well. So that was a common name. So was Joseph. The whole authenticity or lack of it hinges on Mariamene Amara was the inscription, and Jacob Avici, the Canadian filmmaker who was the announcer on the Discovery Channel program, with tortuous logic tries to turn that one into Mary Magdalene. It does not work. If it were Mary Magdalene, of course, then you go up to the 600-to-1 odds that they claim. But since that Discovery program aired, there has been additional discovery on what happened to the contents of those ossuaries. They were taken out and reverently reburied, and they did a trace on that one. They found there were two women and their skeletons, I should say, inside those ossuaries. So Mariamene Amara simply is translated Mariamne and Martha. Just the obvious translation, but to try to turn that into Mary Magdalene is horrendous.
You mentioned Josephus spends a lot of time talking about Herod the Great and his dynasty. What does Josephus tell us, if anything, about Herod's death and his burial?
Well, Josephus gives it quite a bit of detail on Herod's last weeks, months and weeks. By now, he is afflicted, as I say, with so many tormenting diseases that he's now shivering at every draft of wind, and so he goes down to the Winter Palace in Jericho in his last weeks. It never snows down in Jericho. It's 1,200 feet below sea level, and it's always very warm. And here he lived in his winter palace. And he, at this point, tells his sister Salome to arrest the Jewish leaders in the land and put them in prison down there. She asks why she was going to do this. And he says, I know, quote, I know that the Jews will celebrate the moment that I die. And, of course, you know, and nobody likes to die knowing they're going to dance in your grave. And so he's going to give them something to cry about. He says, now I want you to execute all these Jewish leaders the moment I die. So there will be thousands of households weeping at the time that I die. Now, is that the sweet kind of guy who could have killed 12 babies in Bethlehem or so? I think so.
So we're dealing here with a man well attested by history, extra-biblical history and biblical history. And it sounds as though if this does, in fact, through inscription evidence, prove to be his tomb, we've kind of crossed another milestone in biblical archaeology.
No question about it. I mean, each one of these discoveries come along, and contrary to what you hear so often, much more often than not, they affirm the biblical record right from the start. You can quarrel sometimes about the dating and some of the strata, but so often you find an immediate confirmation.
Two quick final questions. How would you respond to someone who says, look, Christians really shouldn't make a big deal about archaeological discoveries because we don't need any evidence to support the truth claims of Christianity?
Well, I would simply tell such a person, you know, fine, that's great for you. What about your neighbor who needs hard proof? What about the others you're trying to bring the good news to? Don't you feel obligated to maybe clear some of the trash away from the temple door, so to speak? And there are so many people who are being bombarded with false evidence about how the faith got started. I reference, of course, the Da Vinci Code as one example of a book of lies, repeatedly, and people believe these because it's in print. No, I think it's very important when the hard evidence comes along and provides beautiful illustration of the fact that our faith is built on fact and not on fiction. I think it's very important that that we listen to Jesus when he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind."
And if that water cooler coworker or acquaintance says, "Hey, did you see that story about King Herod's tomb?" What's the best way we should respond, and how can we use this opportunity to share the gospel of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think I would respond, and it's not surprising that they would find his tomb because he was a very important person, whom we learn very much about in the pages of the New Testament. And we have names of the rulers who show up both in religious and secular history. Pontius Pilate's another one. And there are so many others like that. This shows that the context of the biblical records is absolutely affirming the biblical record itself, which itself is a tremendous advantage that Christianity has compared with other world religious systems whose holy books have no correlation factor at all. There it's a case of blind faith. Rather than a faith that can be affirmed by surrounding evidence.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time. Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day to talk with us.
Thank you, Todd, and I'm glad you're number one in the story right away. That's important.
Well, that's that's part of what Issues Etc. does, folks, is that when the story is there, and this is real fresh out of the oven, we might say, we are able to bring you the very best guests to respond to the story and to put it into its context. And not only that, but to not only bring their expertise to bear upon the story, but also to approach it from a distinctively Christian viewpoint. And to set this story and describe it as significant as it is, should it surprise anybody. Anybody at all, that we can, given enough time and effort, uncover the landmarks, the tombs, the places that are described in Holy Scripture, Old Testament, and New Testament. You know, to a certain degree, maybe we in the 20th and 21st century have bought into a lot of the skepticism of the 19th century when they thought, oh, these places are just made up. They were wrong. And we're discovering more and more as archaeology uncovers more and more that, in fact, it's rather an unassuming claim that the things and the places and the people and the events described in the New Testament actually occurred where they did, involved whom they did, and we can still find evidence of it. Shouldn't surprise anybody. When we come back, we're going to talk about Western women and Islam.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Help wanted: African Americans to join the abortion debate.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Pro-life advocacy groups are seeking new allies in the abortion debate from the African American community. CareNet Vice President Lily Epps said that many blacks have viewed the pro-life cause as a white Republican issue. Too often, pro-lifers have either ignored or been unsuccessful finding support among the nation's inner cities. Hoping for change, some are opening pregnancy resource centers in minority neighborhoods, establishing partnerships with black pastors, and distributing information on abortion alternatives. Tune in next time to find out more about what some are calling a new frontier in the civil rights movement.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Okay, pop quiz. What's the relationship between prayer and the Word of God? Do Christians believe in meditation? And how is Christian spirituality different from other types of spirituality? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is titled, Word God Speaks to Us. It's a Bible study published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can read an excerpt on our homepage, issuesetc.org. We live in a spiritually confused and confusing world. Word God Speaks to Us helps discern truth from error. This helpful Bible study resource costs $8.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Word God Speaks to Us explains the necessity of distinguishing between God's Word of Law and God's Word of Gospel. Word God Speaks to Us by Pastor John Pless. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
I'm not internet savvy, but I think you call them chat rooms, places where communities form online around some common topic. A participant does not have to reveal much, except for an opinion he or she chooses to venture. I wonder what happens when a contributor drops out. Missed very much? Does a community feel a loss? I doubt it. Eastern Market burned down Monday of last week. Eastern Market was a farmer's market kind of place that served residents of Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. The building was a historic landmark, going back to 1873. Unlike a chat room, Eastern Market was a flesh and blood, these are our neighbors kind of place. The president of the Capitol Hill Community Foundation, Nikki Simrat, said, Eastern Market is the heart and soul, the center of our community. Everyone who lives here interacts with it regularly. For many people, it's the center of their social life on weekends. The shock of having it gone is traumatic to people living in this community. Love your neighbor as yourself, Jesus says. If my thesis is true, that there's not much grief when someone drops out of a chat room, then maybe we should think about the physical places where we invest our energies. Here's to rebuilding Eastern Market.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about Western women and Islam. Pastor John Loom joins us here in the studio. He's director of the Ethnic Immigration Institute of Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. This conversation is going to have to answer a big question, which is, why are Western women apparently more attracted to Islam nowadays than ever before? Pastor Loom will be making a presentation tonight beginning at 7 at Concordia Seminary on the issue of Western women and Islam. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address as we come to you live this Tuesday, May the 8th, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Loom, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, thank you.
What is it that is attracting Western women to Islam now more than ever?
Well, first of all, I think we have the truth as Christian Lutherans, and The question about what attracts Western women to Islam comes from the fact that the Muslim men are very assertive, very determined, and powerful, and of course they have money on their side. So these are some of the practical issues that attract Western women to Islam.
So is it something that women are finding deficient in Western culture, that they are finding in Islamic culture, not only as a religion?
Well, yeah, it's more cultural issue because, of course, things like dressing, and they have the veil and the long dress and kind of modesty makes some of the Western women very attractive. It's coming from the cultural side of Islam.
So in that way, it's almost, in Western society, it's a countercultural move for them to be interested in Islam's culture. I was listening to the news about 6 months back, and there was a story on National Public Radio about Hispanic women who were, especially on the West Coast, immigrants largely, who were leaving behind their family's heritage of the Roman Catholic faith to look and looking seriously at Islam, many of them converting to a very orthodox form of Islam. Is the interest here greater among some Western women than others?
Yes, it is. Well, of course, the Hispanic, that I would need to look more deeply into. My orientation and observation has been, strictly speaking, Caucasian and European women. So again, it's more cultural, and that's been the issue. And we want to revert that, because I feel that as Christian Lutherans, we have the truth. Aside from culture, I mean, this is all about truth, and since we have it, and also it's scriptural.
So, along with their attraction to the Islamic culture, the Islamic way of life that these women find there, as far as you can tell, are they being attracted by the particular religious views of Islam?
Yeah, well, Islam, of course, has things like the five daily prayers, the fasting, and such things. And, of course, the Sharia is there, too, which sometimes the Western women seem not to be adhered to within the Western culture. So these are part of the things that culturally attract them to Islam.
Why do you think Western observers find it surprising that Western women would be attracted to Islam?
Well, surprising. Since post-9/11, for some reason, in fact, I think our observation has been that a large number of Western women has turned over or converted to Islam. Well, that needs to be investigated a lot much more, but that's been our observation.
What kind of Islam, you mentioned Europe and the United States.
Yeah.
How does Islam as a religion and as a culture differ in the Western world from Islamic countries? I think maybe sometimes people would think, well, it's one thing to wear the veil, but if these Western women really had to live in a society that was truly governed every day under Sharia law, Islam wouldn't be so attractive to them.
Well, take, for example, my home country, the Gambia, women are expected. By the way, my country has 98% Muslim, and it's expected that the women should dress more modestly. Now, in the West, for example, I mean, the kind of dress Western women, the kind of Hollywood dress is not it's far from distasteful. And I think the women are looking for something about dignity and respect. I think that's why they are prone towards the Islamic culture, which is very much Sunni-type Islam.
Do they find an element of protection with the Islamic customs that they aren't finding in Western culture?
Yeah, that's true. I think, again, it goes with respect and dignity and caring and which is what these foreign Muslim men who came to America and England and Europe really offer to Western women who don't find this among their Western men. Yeah, that protection and help and caring and loving.
If a non-Muslim woman marries a Muslim man in the West, even under Western Islam, is she expected to convert to Islam in marriage there?
Oh, yes, certainly. Now, we are Christians, and the Westerners are described as the people of the book, and that's permissible. that a Muslim man can marry a Westerner and indeed a Christian.
So does it work the other way around if a Muslim woman happens to marry a non-Muslim man? Would that be considered A-OK, too?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's very one-sided. A Muslim man can marry a Christian, but not the other way around. Because, first of all, by Islamic understanding, we are seen and understood to be the kafir, unbelievers. So that's part of the evangelism from the Muslim side. And when a Muslim marries a Westerner, it is obligatory that that Western woman should automatically become a Muslim.
What should these female and Western converts to Islam, what should they know about Islam going in, beyond just the fact that they're going to be more protected, perhaps more respected and cared for in an Islamic culture than in general Western culture? What should they know and be warned about?
Well, I think they need to be aware, first of all, that it is allowed, kind of polygamy is allowed in Islam. A Muslim can marry up to four wives, which is really not the Western cultural appetite. So they need, number one, to know that if they go into marriage, they must be thinking of having other mates. Also, they need to know that there are cultural differences between the West and the Arab culture, such things as extended family. They also need to know that the man is always the boss of the home. And these are some of the things which one needs to be aware of before they get into marriage.
Should they also be concerned about if in the future, after their conversion to Islam, they should have a change of heart? And want to become something other than a Muslim, perhaps convert to Christianity?
Well,
what would become of them?
Our observation has been that when such a situation arises, the women are in limbo. They are neither Muslims nor Christian. And this is why I, on my own part, I'm trying to alert the church to look for such women who are neither Muslim or Christian in such situation and try to encourage them to return to the Christian faith. And if they were never Christian, to evangelize them and bring them to Christ.
Talk briefly, you mentioned before that in your home country it's 98% Islam. Talk briefly about living as a Christian in a predominantly Muslim country.
Well, pre-colonial days, we had a very happy and coexistence. But since post-independence, the Muslims have been in control. And in some respects, the Christians have been subjected to unethical treatment. For instance, if you're not a Muslim and you are denied from getting a good jobs, there is a kind of discrimination because you are Christian. So it's sometimes very hard to live in such countries or such contexts as a Christian.
Is there Sharia law in your home country?
Well, they've not implemented Sharia law yet, but under the ground it's existing. So and it's sometimes applied. In fact, a lot of Christian women are being converted through marriage to the Muslim faith. So these are some of the things that we are observing in my own country and elsewhere.
In your country, are Christians, would it be safe to say that Christians are second-class citizens, given the fact that they're such a small minority, too?
At least that's how I feel, and many Christians do feel that.
Does it impact areas like education for your children? You mentioned employment. What about the ability for Christians to worship freely, to build churches, to repair church property, things like that?
Well, we have some old churches. They are still allowed. And thankfully, we have a president that is very kind-hearted and looked very respectfully towards Christian and the Christian church. So you can still worship and openly, but there are areas and some Muslim areas where you are not allowed to build churches.
Is it the official? I don't know if this is even an applicable concept. Is Islam the official state religion there?
Well, it's not been declared, so to speak. But in practice, really, Islam is the official religion. Also, Christians are tolerated. But again, I want to be fair, it's the country has not yet been declared as a Muslim country.
Many in the West, and I think, again, especially after 9/11, have looked at Islam and they've said, well, okay, there's obviously a danger when it comes to Islam and its radical forms. But countries like Turkey, or countries like perhaps even Iran and other places, African countries that are dominated by Islam, if we're not seeing terrorism there, then Islam is a benign force in society. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, it depends on your definition, because by and large, because we are polygamous or type of society, you tend to find Christians and Muslims coexisting side by side. In fact, in my own family background, I still have members of my family who profess to be Muslim, and yet we have some who profess to be Christian, so we kind of coexist. But in some other countries, it's not true.
How much in countries where Islam dominates is Islam simply the culture? We've talked with one of your colleagues, Dr. Victor Raj, who comes from India, and he says Hinduism in India is the culture. People don't even think about it as a religion. They think about it as being, this is what it means to be Indian in this country. How much of that is prevails in Islamic countries when it comes to how people think about Islam?
Well, that's a difference between African Islam and Arab Islam, culturally speaking. Because with us from west coast of Africa, since we were colonized by either the French or the English, we kind of adopted that culture, English culture, which is different from the Arab Muslim. But all the same, Islam is intertwined. Islam is cultural. Is also, you have the faith dimension of Islam. And sometime in Africa, the two coexist, the culture and the religion itself, side by side.
Pastor John Loom is our guest. He joins us here in the studio on this Tuesday, the 8th of May. We're talking about Western women in Islam. He's director of the Ethnic Immigration Institute of Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Pastor Loom is going to be making a presentation tonight beginning at 7 o'clock at Concordia Seminary on the issue of Western women in Islam. So let's talk about what you mentioned several times in our conversation so far, and that is, how do we counteract the attraction of Western women into Islam? Where do we begin?
First of all, it must be biblical. I like to quote from St. John's Gospel, "Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through Jesus Christ." Then there is also the cultural side. We need to educate our Christian folks, our Western women, that be aware that when once you marry to a Muslim, you are heading for multiple wives, and you may be the second class among the wives. And Islam allows four wives. There is also the cultural difference, for instance, about wearing the dress, the veil. There is also many Western habits which may not be tolerated any longer once you embrace Islam. So these are the few examples which we need to teach our Western women to realize before they enter into such marriages.
What are the Western habits that you're talking about there that might not be tolerated
well,
if a woman converts?
Being tolerant and being kind and hospitable, having equal say, and also having the freedom to express and freedom to do what you need to do, freedom of exercising your belief and opinion. These are some of the Western cultures which we so much appreciate here and may not be tolerated in the Muslim or Arabic culture.
Now, there is a very westernized form of Islam, especially here in the U.S., where a Muslim may have so integrated into Western culture that a lot of these things you're talking about may have fallen away. They're in their culture very Western, but they still maintain their prayers and they still go to the mosque. Is that a different story?
Yeah, it is. I have observed that a large number of Muslims who come here, yeah, true, they keep saying their prayers. And this is where I think we as Christians can take advantage of that disconnect with their family. And since they are here, without having the family traps, we can share the gospel or at least point them to churches and synagogues. Well, I would say churches first and foremost, where they could hear and be familiar with Christian ideals and ethics and culture. That could help them to at least be attracted towards the Christian faith.
The barriers to witnessing to a Muslim man are great, obviously. You mentioned family. What does a Muslim man face, even if he's living in the West and his family is, say, elsewhere in the world? What does he face from his family if he considers or converts to Christianity?
Well, there is death threat, and you can be ostracized. Remember that Islam is very communal, and you can be denied, because once you convert, it's understood to be a betrayal from not only the faith, but also from the community. So these are some of the, so to speak, penalty or threat that one may face.
What would a woman face, a Muslim woman, for converting to Christianity from her family?
Well, it would be almost the same thing, just as the man, because there is no difference or segregation. So the same thing that, for example, being segregated or ostracized would be equally the same thing that the woman will face.
I've heard from other guests that in the Muslim mindset, women really have no hope of paradise after death. And if they have any at all, it's in connection with their husband. It's because they are married to a Muslim man. Is this generally true?
That's generally true, and very true in the African context, because I know of some Muslim women, in fact, after saying the Salat, which is the five daily prayers, will go and stoop down and say thank you to their husbands, because it is the husbands who will lead them to Ajana, which is the word for paradise.
How do we reassert a distinctly Christian respect and protection for women that many of these Western women are seeking and finding only in Islam? How do we reassert that? Because Christianity holds a high view of women and in fact, within the family and the headship of man, a very protective view of women, too.
Well, I would say, for instance, that they should look at Lutheran Christian men and very loving and respectful. Well, like, for instance, when you're going to places like church, you go as a family, be kind and hospitable to your wife, treat your wife equally, and expect that what you do to your wife, she would also do to you, kind of equal treatment and respect and love. These are some of the things which are already existing within the Christian family. So we should continue to reassert that and enforce it.
If the trend of Western women to be attracted to Islam and then the continued Islamization of Europe, first and foremost, and then perhaps even the United States, if this goes unabated, what are we headed for, Pastor Loom?
Sorry, day. I'm all the freedoms we have would be denied. And in fact, the Muslims would institute the Sharia law. And that means that we would be abide and governed by the Sharia law, and Christians in the West will become secondary and second citizens of their own country. And then we will be enforced to adhere to the Muslim law. There will be a lot of segregation. Like, for instance, in the Sharia law, if you steal, your one hand will be chopped off, and all those things will be in operation.
Pastor John Loom is director of the Ethnic Immigration Institute of Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's going to be making a presentation tonight, beginning at 7 o'clock at Concordia Seminary, on the issue of Western women and Islam. Pastor Loom, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much for accepting me.
That presentation tonight at 7 o'clock at Concordia Seminary on the issue of Western women and Islam, Pastor John Loom will be making it. When we come back from this break, Pastor David Anderson is going to be our guest. He's president and CEO of the Anglican American Council. It's actually the American Anglican Council based in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, you probably heard about this because over the weekend, they made a big move. An African bishop from Worldwide Anglicanism came to the United States, and in the course of his visit, he ordained a bishop for a new branch of the Anglican Communion. At least that's what some people are calling it. He ordained a bishop for a new branch of the Anglican Communion in the United States, distinct from and apart from the Episcopal Church USA. So we'll be talking with Pastor David Anderson on that issue when we come back from this break. Then at the, 4:30, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will join us. Usually we have him for an hour. Today, only for a half hour. We're going to talk about the presidential elections in France and in Turkey. Very important stories. I know that at least the French one has caught his attention. And then, after that conversation with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, we have audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We're going to deal with a number of stories from all across the spectrum. Dr. Frank Beckwith, who's a regular guest on this program, he's converted to Roman Catholicism. It's actually made headlines. And we'll find out why. We'll hear some AP audio from him about his conversion to Roman Catholicism. There's a CNN story on churches harboring illegal immigrants. It's a big question that's not going away. More immigration becomes a story. We'll also have an ABC News report, as time permits, on a church that is struggling with the issue of whether or not to permit a registered sex offender to join their ranks. They're going to have a vote about it. They're going to try and figure out whether or not they can accept into membership a registered sex offender. And then an NBC News story titled, Will Fred Thompson Run? Believe it or not, Fred Thompson isn't running for president yet. But if you gauged it by how much news coverage he's getting, how many interviews he is granting on the issue of his presidential run, it's a wonder that he isn't. Most people know him from the Law and Order TV drama. Well, he's also a U.S. senator, and some people consider him a serious contender for the 08 presidential elections. If just he would announce, we'll talk about that during audio open lines in the last hour of Issues, etc. Stay tuned.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, etc.